Food fans, Alton Brown here. You're listening to the Alton Brown Cast, recording at the moment up in the little room above my garage in Marietta, Georgia. But we're soon going to be transferring to an interview that we recorded very, very recently in New York City with two really interesting people, Susie Fogelson and Bob Tushman, executives at the Food Network, who have been very responsible for the Food Network Star series in its, well, gosh, nine years now of being on Food Network. They, of course, play the network on the show, and they're in an interesting position because they actually I mean, they're not the whole network, but Susie Fogelson's in charge of some big funny marketing term, and it's got to do with branding, and Bob Tushman's head of or the general manager of programming. So we're going to be talking to them about their kind of dual jobs and about the whole Food Network star situation. So that's coming up on the show. And there'll be some other stuff, too, for you to squander your time on. So don't go away. Some fun facts about figs, which, by the way, I have been cooking low and slow in the oven. I actually half them, and I put them in muffin tins, okay, so that the cut side is facing up. And I just sprinkle on a little bit of kosher salt because it's me, a little bit of a black pepper, and then just a sprinkling of sherry vinegar, and I cook them real low and slow. They're almost like I'm making oven-dried tomatoes, and then I chop them up and churn them into ice cream, vanilla ice cream, into which I have put just a little bit of the aforementioned sherry vinegar. I've been using more sherry vinegar lately than balsamic vinegar. I'm just not a really big balsamic vinegar fan, I have to admit, but I do like sherry vinegar a great deal. Anyway, it makes a really good fig ice cream, just something to think about. You know, technically, you know, a lot of folks don't realize figs are flowers that have basically inverted on themselves. The seeds on the inside are actually the fruit. What else do we know that does that? Well, not exactly the same way, but the seeds on the outside of a strawberry are actually the fruit. So it's kind of like an inverted version, outside, inside, outside version of a strawberry. It's the Alton Brown cast. Alton Brown, we're actually here in Jada De Laurentiis' dressing room at Food Network, which is significantly larger than mine. It has some really nice flowers, most of which I'll steal before the end of the day. And she has a potted, I don't know what that is over there in the corner, but Jada has that. And I'm sitting here with Bob Tushman and Susie Fogelson, her two of the people that have been here longer than I have. and Bob, has your title changed through the years of the time that we have known each other here?
Yes, it changed many times, actually.
So what did it start? When 10 years ago?
15 years ago.
Okay, so actually, 15 years ago, what was your title?
2 days ago was my 15th anniversary here. I came on August 3rd, 1998, as an executive producer.
Executive producer, and now?
Now I am senior vice president / general manager.
So you're almost running the network.
Brooke Johnson, our beloved boss, is running the
beloved
network.
Beloved. Yes. But if God forbid, something happened to yes. Brooke, you would be the Al Haig, and you would step in and you would be in charge
of the network. I think of it as I'm the second runner-up. So if she cannot fulfill her duties as Miss America of the food world,
Should something happen.
Yes.
Should something happen, you would actually. So you're second in command.
Yes.
Yes. Susie.
Yes.
I've known you since, I mean, we were both kind of junior folks here, because I remember you working for Adam.
Uh-huh. I've been here 13.
So what was your title then?
Right, just newbie, a baby, 13. 13 years.
What was your title then?
I got hired as director of marketing, director of consumer marketing.
And now?
I'm senior vice president of marketing.
So how many people would have to fall under the subway train between Brooke and Bob for you to run the Food Network?
I don't know. What do you think, Bob?
Come on.
I would say, in all fairness, we're pretty equal in okay. what we run, because basically I oversee, there's a couple of us, we each oversee big chunks of the network. Mm-hmm. So I oversee basically anything that's on air in programming time. Susie oversees everything that's not programming time on air, as well as a lot of off air promos and things. There's somebody else who heads new business, and somebody else who heads digital, mm-hmm. somebody else who heads culinary. We really all work really closely as a team mm-hmm. together. And so it's pretty evenly, even though I have a couple extra letters in my title, we really run equally. And I think we think of each other's equals, at least I do.
Mm-hmm. I think it's flat. Brooke keeps it flat like that.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing?
I think she feels it is, yeah. And I think we love working as a collaborative team. Yeah. I think that she ultimately makes the decisions, of course, but she's so open to opinions. She will ask, non-programming people opinions about programming. She will ask Bob opinions about marketing and promo. Like, you cannot be sensitive, and certainly she doesn't want you to be shy, because she will honestly ask for feedback about anything to help guide her.
Both of you have been here since this was a niche network. This was a specialty boutique network, mm-hmm. and it's not anymore. Mm-hmm. This is mainstream, big-time entertainment stuff now. And both of you, in your own way, have shepherded that change, that transformation. But the point is that there aren't too many networks where there are people that are making decisions and guiding networks who are actually known to fans. And how many networks does that happen at? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't really think of too many. So you guys have been here. One.
One other.
Bravo, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Bob, what do you see in culture that allowed a network that my grandmother couldn't believe existed, because who the heck would want to watch people cook on television, to a network that unifies millions of people around the United States? How did you see that unfolding and happening?
That's a big question, Alton.
Well, and it is, but it's one that, yeah. I mean, even though I've known you guys for a long time, we've never actually talked about the enormity of what has happened here, because it's actually hard to wrestle with in a way of what happened here.
Well, you know, when we started, because we were talking about a niche subject and a subject that is inert. I mean, food does not move. It, you know, unlike, say, Animal Planet or History, which is about things happening, food is about objects that do not move unless you make them move. So we knew that we had to find big personalities that could bring food to life. And we found people like Alton Brown. We found people like Emeril, people like Bobby, and then eventually people like Jada and Rachel and Guy, people who've all become one-word household names now. But they were really the secret sauce. Emeril was the very first person who we brought on who broke out of people who just watched cooking. I remember my old boss, Eileen Opetut, saying when she walked to Emeril Live, she was shocked to see huge guys in Giants jackets yelling and applauding when Emeril threw garlic in. Yeah, garlic!
Bam!
And she said, these are people who never would have been caught dead 5 years earlier watching a cooking show. Now they're not only watching it, they're watching it like a sporting event.
How did that happen?
Well, I think Emeril was the very first person who broke out and who was a guy who could speak to everybody. He didn't just speak to women. He didn't just speak to sort of an elite group of foodies. He was a regular guy. He was down the street. He was an exciting personality, passionate about food, funny, warm, and he really made people feel good about food. He made guys in Giants jackets feel good about watching a cooking show.
Was that game-changing?
Was game-changing. It broke us out. It got people talking about, I'm watching this cooking show and you won't believe it. And he had a band and he had fun and he had guest stars on and he made cooking he opened the doors to the cooking tent and let everybody in. I think he was the first person. I think you did a lot, if I may say so, in terms of making food information funny and interesting and vital. And I know so many people who say, Alton Brown taught me to cook. I don't think you meant yours as a cooking show to teach people to cook, but because you made food so interesting to listen to and to learn about, you made people who never would have watched an ordinary cooking show, a person behind a counter cooking, you made people watch it and feel good about watching it as entertainment. And in the process, they actually learned to cook. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was 100% the personalities that brought it out. And then we started finding formats that worked. So Iron Chef, starting with the Japanese version, and I wish I could take any credit because it was brilliant for it, but bringing it in and treating it like a Japanese science fiction movie and dubbing it badly, and it turned it into a cult classic. And people on college campuses started watching and laughing.
And drinking games and everything that came out of it.
And whatever else you do when you're at college watching things like that. And I think that was a game changer. And then we started, as the world started broadening out, we started finding formats that got people out of the kitchens and that worked and started making a bigger audience. And I think around 2005, we started finding shows like Bobby's Throwdown, which was just a fantastic insight. It was Bobby's idea. It was a fantastic idea about getting people, surprising them, ambushing them. And these were sort of real people who were good at one thing. They weren't like necessarily great cooks, but they knew how to make one dish better than almost anybody in the country. And they went up against one of the most iconic chefs in the country and won most of the time because they were so good at that dish. That was a game changer. Chopped was a game changer. We just kept finding formats that made cooking interesting to people who just like being a great television entertainment. And that's really what we look to do is we find the personalities and the formats that turn food, cooking in the world of food into great television entertainment.
Susie, I would throw this at you because this you're really responsible in a lot of ways for the branding of this network. Have you found that in the last few years, well, I guess maybe the last decade even, that finding a brand alignment for a channel that used to be about cooking shows to being about something much larger? How do you even tackle that? How do you carry this?
Yeah. So we have serious cooking food enthusiasts. And then we have people that love food entertainment that aren't going to pick up a pan and don't really need instructional information and aren't turned on by that kind of programming. So
in other words, people who aren't going to cook.
Aren't going to cook. They want to lean back and they want to be entertained. And there's other parts of our brand and of our schedule that where people are excited to lean in and learn. And not that those are different people. They may be different people, but they just may be someone who has a different need throughout their day. Right? So let's take our sort of typical viewer, 42-year-old female.
And is that, by the way, typical?
Yeah. Well,
42-year-old
a little
female?
Ideal and typical for us.
That's ground zero, kind of?
Although I would say, I think people would be surprised by the number of male viewers because I think when the channel was launched, people imagined it would be a female channel. And the truth is, we have a lot of shows that are closer to 50-50, male-female. So we in every way, we think of ourselves as a dual audience network.
Okay. Totally. Right. I guess what I'm saying is just if throughout the day, let's say that she is looking for ideas and inspiration for what to make for dinner that night, right? So from 4 to 7, we might be able to speak to her. That is a little bit more of the lean in, what am I going to make tonight? Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure that on every platform we're helping her do that. But then after dinner, she doesn't want instructional information. She really wants to lean back and watch Restaurant Impossible. So it's the same person that you're reaching with a different idea, with a different promise.
So there's like a switch that flips at a particular point of the day because their life changes at a particular point of the day. I'm not worried about getting food on the table anymore. I'm now worried about, I just want to be entertained.
Yes, I think that that's true. I also think that there are people that will never worry about what they're making for dinner that night. And let's be perfectly sexist here, say him, and he wants to chill out and watch. I'm just making the point.
Fine,
I know
fine.
Plenty of men that cook, and I love men that cook, including the ones at this table. But I feel like what we've moved to is not relying just on being able to inspire people to cook and teaching them great food information, but now we're entertaining people that might not be into that food genre. So one of the campaigns that we did back in 2005 was Food Network. It's way more than cooking.
Way more than cooking. I remember it.
And way at that point. Well, way is kind of in now because you're saying way in Cutthroat too. But I think that was a really big statement for us to make, that we're getting out of the kitchen and we're doing travel and we're doing competition. And it's just plain entertaining whether or not you ever plan to pick up a pan, which is a big idea for us because we're called Food Network. And so I think that that is the wonderful thing, to be a passion brand, because that's really what we are. There are
a passion brand.
Only a couple, I think, out there. ESPN would be one of them, I would suggest. I think MTV also has a lot of passion fans, certainly in the music days they did. And I think food, it's a genre of programming that's here to stay. It's about food programming. Food is at the center. It's, to me, it's like comedy. To me, it's like drama. It's food programming, and it can house sort of all of those ideas.
So you see it as a story hub that is eternal in a way,
mm-hmm.
because there's always interest in food. We are united. I mean, I have to be frank. The thing that is so wonderful about this subject matter to me is that it is the one thing that unites people. Is there ever a time where you're playing this game of, wow, this is entertaining, but it's not quite in our mission hub? I mean, how do you ever draw the line? Because as you're growing outwards, and those of us that have been around the network for a while, I mean, we see the evolution of becoming a mainstream network, a mainstream entertainment network. How do you draw the line of saying, no, this isn't us?
The truth is, I think we're going to keep, the audience will tell you when you've gone too far. And the nice thing is,
can you rely on them?
Well, sure, because ultimately they decide what they want to watch. What we can do is put out shows that we think are good. I mean, we have a lot of tenets of what is very important for us as a network. So we're known for very high quality programming. We want very rich storytelling. We want great characters. We want really intriguing formats. And the truth is, the food world is wide, because if you think about food as cooking, okay, that's pretty narrow. But you think about all the things that touch food. It's wide. That can be supermarkets. That can be grocery stores. It can be people who make food products. It can be people who make the containers that make food products. I mean, there's really almost an infinite amount of corners of the world that touch the food world.
Because food touches everything.
Yeah. Food touches everything.
Infinite variations. Infinite.
Yeah. And I think we're trying some shows now. So we have a show coming up next month called Thieves, Inc. And it's about a man and a woman who run a security firm. And the majority of their customers actually turn out to be people related to the food business, whether it's retail stores or supermarkets or grocery stores. There are people, there are places that sell food where there is a lot of theft. And what they do is they sort of stake out places and with security cameras, and they watch and they will see who's thieving, but they also go to test them. They will dress up in costumes. This is what they really do. They will infiltrate the store and see how much they can steal themselves. So they get inside the mind of a thief, of a shoplifter, and they go in and they test the boundaries of the store to see how much they can get away. And then they go back and say to the owner, look, in 15 minutes, we took $3,500 worth of merchandise off your shelves, and nobody stopped us. We walked out the door with it. Here's the 10 flaws we saw, and here's how you're going to correct them. Now, it turns out these people are actually really funny, interesting characters. They have true expertise in this area. It's not what you would think of as a traditional food show. They don't cook. They don't manipulate food, but they work with food businesses. And watching them at work, we found fascinating. We sort of tested it quietly with a lot of our viewers who found it really interesting. They were surprised it's on Food Network. When it rolls out in September, we'll find out if all of our viewers will agree and say, yeah, this could be a food show. I find it entertaining. It's in the food world, not the traditional sense of the food world, mm-hmm. but we're fascinated by it. Or they may say, we're not going to watch this. The viewers let you know because ultimately they are the ultimate judges. And in this day and age, you know, they decide, they have hundreds of choices at any minute of the day. They'll tell you in a heartbeat, yep, going to watch that. Nope, can't make me watch that. Like, I won't eat my vegetables.
So in the end, do the viewers define this network?
I think that's true in any part of television, they will tell you. Because ultimately, your business is dependent on how many, or I think almost any business is dependent on pleasing your consumers. You can and should introduce them to new areas. But I think that's what we try to do is we want to introduce our viewers to the widest palette of flavors that we can and see how much they want to eat, but we want to give them the most options possible mm-hmm. and stretch the limits. We've been stretching the limits every year since I've been here to what people thought a food show could be. When I arrived in 1998, a food show was by definition a cooking show. It was the only yes. food show known to man.
You could not remove cooking from food in a way. Although, all unwrapped. But that was after, one of the first shows that did that.
But in 1998, we did 100% of the shows we did were studio cooking shows. Yep. They had before that they had done talk shows and things like Getting Healthy, but the majority of shows were cooking shows. And so the thought, if you had said 1998, we're going to do a restaurant makeover show, people would be like, a what? Like no one would have understood even what it was. They had no reference points. Right. So every year since I've been here, we have tried to introduce shows that would stretch the boundaries, and the viewers have gone along with us happily on it. Not everywhere. We obviously had shows that have failed. But for the most part, as we went into docu-soaps, we had mm-hmm. Ace of Cakes. Mm-hmm. We went into competition shows. We went into a really imaginative competition shows like Chopped. They have gone with us all the way. Mm-hmm. So that's we will keep doing that until they say, you know what? That's like, we're not going to watch that. And say, okay, let us take you in a different direction then. We'll come up with 10 new shows for you.
But the odds are really, I mean, against you, right? I mean, hits are hard. Hits are hard. I think 70% of shows don't work, you know, just in TV in general.
Yeah, 70 to 90.
Imagine the budget that you're putting towards Essence Losers.
Do you consider this network to be ahead of the curve on hits or behind the curve on hits? Where are you? I mean, if you had to name the hit, if you had to count the hits in your head.
I don't know.
I'm not sure we're different 50, from any.
50-50 or, you know.
I think we go through periods where we introduce hits. I think we go through periods where we try things and the viewers go, okay. We've had very few flops where people have just rejected en masse something, where they've just – the numbers just astound you at how low they are. That rarely happens with us. Most of the shows are at least decent, but not the numbers that we want to have to keep growing.
The star-making business, which Food Network has been probably better at than any other network, frankly, that I can think of. How do you manage that? That would drive me insane. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's not, you know, I don't decide what shows go on air, so that's really Bob's knack. But I would say that even a great personality doesn't make for a great show, right? There's so many factors at play. So there's some great people that I would, without naming names, have not found the right show formats. It's pretty spectacular when you think about the number of talent that we have between food and cooking. Mm-hmm. It could be upwards of 100 talent, you know? I mean, it's just massive.
That many?
That many.
Really?
Well, I would say not all at the same level and not all, you know, working to the same extent or in the same amount of shows. But collectively, yeah, when we put them all together, it's probably, you know, 75 busy, 100.
Yeah, but how many times a year, a decade, do you look and say, oh my gosh, there it is. That's special.
Well, do you feel that way?
I feel that it is once in a lifetime to find people who you think are just instantly out of the box, instantaneous stars. That's only happened a handful of times, I think, when you see people. But I think finding people who you think have great potential and then finding the right show for them, the right format for them, because that's where the alchemy comes in. It's not just personality. It's finding the exact perfect expression of that personality through a format that uses all of their gifts and puts it together in a way that people want to watch. That's the hard part.
I mean, you're someone who has been, Bob, responsible for, I mean, Rachel Ray, certainly, and her success, Jada, and her success. These are people that you basically found in a way. Were those instances where you realized that you had great raw material and you just had to find the right format? Or were there been times where you said, like, I just need to stay, just let it go and it'll happen? I mean, how do you treat that star stuff?
I don't think it's ever hard. And I don't want to take credit for almost anybody, because TV is such a team sport, and it is so much a combination of so many of the programmers, really talented programmers I have working with me, come up with the concept. So it's not like I sit in a room all day and spin out these fantastic. It's a lot of people working very hard and great producers. And I do think a lot of it is also Susie's part of the business, taking the people and then figuring out how to insinuate them off air, in magazines, in press, in promos, how they're positioned. We work very closely together and I think you have to have that to be able to take someone from sort of plucking them out of their everyday life and turning them into a star. We're also lucky because we're a single subject network, we can take a person and put them into four different shows. So I can take somebody and put them in, create their primary vehicle in primetime. I can have them guest star on Thanksgiving Live. I can have them appear as a judge in Chopped. I can put them on as a guest star on other people's cooking shows.
You diversify the portfolio in a way.
The sample, to get people to sample.
And I also think we are trying very consciously to build a brand for them. And so it's finding the right way to position them and also then to keep reintroducing that message to our viewers. So the more they see them in different circumstances, the more they get to know them and the more they get to like them and the more they get to see what that person's all about. And eventually they feel like family to them, which is what our goal is.
Family. Why is that a goal?
Because I think one of the things that's most unique about Food Network is the feeling that there is a Food Network family. I can't think of any other network that refers to their talent as a family. Their talent are usually stars in their individual shows, but they're not really part of, I don't think of a network, a TLC family, a Bravo family, a History family. They're just talented people who have a show. But Food Network, there is a family, and I think you see it when you see our magazine. I think you see it when you see our specials are on air. And I think there is both a real friendship and camaraderie that you have with a lot of your stars. And I think there's a perceived family that maybe, I think people think that you actually do hang out here a lot and cook and hang out and drink and dine with your friends here.
Do you think that happens because we as a society and as a culture, because food is a family-centric subject, that people automatically assume that we have that, or how does that get, is that manifested by the fans, or is that manifested by us to them?
Exactly.
How does that work?
I think what makes it unique is that you're not actors. Actually, I think you can act, Alton.
That wasn't what I was thinking.
What makes the promos experience lovely.
But you think that what is key for people that are on Food Network is that we are who we are.
Absolutely.
And there's an honesty there.
There is a Food Network sort of core philosophy about respecting the people on our shows. So even when we have very dramatic shows, and in Restaurant Impossible, I mean, Robert Irvine will get into almost, you know, fisticuffs with somebody. He is like in their face.
Yeah, it gets scary sometimes. I actually get like tense watching that show sometimes.
But it is in the service of helping them. And hopefully it's a transformational experience for them. I do think that there's a positive transformational aspect to almost every program we do that puts in people's minds an expectation of goodness, family, collaboration. It's not just TV shows. There is a spirit that permeates the entire network. And I do think that leads to this positive feeling of wanting to be part of it, wanting to have it in your home, wanting to, I think if people could invite you and Rachel and Jada and Bobby and Guy, you know, and Robert, like to their home to have dinner with them, they would do it in a heartbeat. They feel like they know you.
Yeah.
And they want to be with you.
I think they actually do know us. I mean, most of us are exactly the same people on TV as off TV. And it's funny. I mean, I'll have people, you know, who'll stop me someplace and talk, and they'll be like, "You're just like you are on TV." And I'm like, "Yeah."
Mm-hmm. That's probably thrilling.
Pretty much, because that's me.
Yeah.
But I do think that that is something that is unique about Food Network is mm-hmm. that the people that, you know, fans feel they know us, and they do. They do because they know acting. They know the difference. Mm-hmm. And there's an honesty that I think is required of this. And I think that a lot of, you know, most of the people that have become real stars on this network have the ability to have that honesty. Which brings me to another question. Food Network star. I'll make full circle here. You guys have the unique experience of being in front of the camera and back behind the camera. And so one of the things that I have in my time watching the show and then being involved in that show is that you're always looking for authenticity, perhaps even authenticity above all else. And I would ask you, is that true? In all the years that you guys have done that show, and I'm really interested in your experience being in front of the camera, we'll get into that in a minute. What is the number one thing that can't be built, can't be manufactured, can't be, what does a person have to have in order to move forward in that show and potentially be a winner and a star on the network that you've seen through that competition?
It sounds cliche to say, but it, you know?
We'll talk about it. I don't think that's a cliche. Well, if it is a cliche, it's an honest one. It, what is it to you?
I think honesty is a big part of it. Just a comfort level with who you are, something unique about you, because while food is specific, it is very broad, right? So having a lane and a point of view to be able to build a brand off of is a really important thing, because there's a whole lot of stuff going on in Food Network at any given time. So who are you? I think it's, you know, there's a twinkle. It's a twinkle in an eye. It's a confidence. It's a way of, you know, facial, an expression you make, a gesture, a phrase. I mean, I think it comes out in a few different ways, but I feel like it is something unique that I just can't take my eyes off of. And you just know it when you see it. It's very hard to explain. I just think you know it when you see it.
Being on camera, you must have realized now, is not always the cakewalk that it may seem to be, because now you've had a lot of experience being on camera. You've got to become concerned with how do I look? How do I sound? How am I coming across?
I fidget. That's my issue. I fidget, and then I used to upspeak, and Bob corrected me on that one.
All right, what's upspeak? I don't even know what that means.
It's, you know, maybe next time, you know, you're doing a demo, you might want to organize your thoughts first.
Okay. So upspeak is like, just going up.
Yeah, and questioning myself. And I said, but who am I to tell these people what to do? Bob said, it's your job, okay? That's what you're doing here. Tell people what to do, but don't upspeak because it makes it sound like you don't have authority.
It makes you weak.
Yes.
So you got two jobs. You're on camera talent,
right,
in a show that needs to rate well and needs to entertain people, and you've got to judge, and you've got to mentor.
And
look good doing it. Well, no, and look good doing it.
Yeah. What makes you insecure, Bob? On camera.
I'd love to know that.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say this, but because I was a producer for so many years, I'm very aware that I know when where the camera is placed. I know exactly what I will look like in that shot when I look at it months later in the edit. And Susie, I think, has nearly perfect looks. I think Susie was made to be on camera. I do. I think I've said this to people, never to Susie. I think Susie has it. I think she has that charismatic quality that I'm fascinated when I watch her on air. And I also think she's gorgeous. And so I think the camera naturally loves her. And I think she's really dynamic and interesting, ever interesting on camera. I do not think of myself in the same way. I don't like my looks on camera.
What do you like about you on camera?
I think I can say interesting, witty things sometimes.
Sometimes.
I think sometimes I don't.
But you don't think you're being a little hard on yourself there?
I do. Silver Fox?
Well, thank you.
Is that what you call him? Silver Fox?
See, but
I like that. I like that a lot.
I've trained the directors on the show that they know the camera has to be placed like directly across from me. I mean, when the camera's off to the side, I'm a middle-aged Jew. Like, you don't put a camera on the, like, on profile on a middle-aged Jew.
I feel Bob stares at my profile. I can see him staring at my profile.
Oh, it's a guy. Well, you know what? often when other people are talking, I'm sitting next to Susie. I can't actually see beyond her because she has all this hair. So I have to pretend I'm looking at you or at Bobby or Jada while they're talking. I'm actually just looking at Susie's profile and nodding.
And nodding?
Yeah, pretending. So I spent hours looking at Susie's nearly perfect profile.
And I've looked at Bob's too.
So I'll tell you your strengths. From performing alongside of you, Bob's strengths are you come up with these wonderful lines that are very succinct, that are very cuttable. You know, the very like, oh, that's, yeah, we're using that line. You'll think for a moment and you'll come up with five words that like encapsulate everything. So you're an editor's performer from that standpoint. And Susie, you always pull out this emotional thing that always, if it isn't genuine, don't ever tell me because it plays completely genuine, which is that you actually really care about everybody and you get really involved with them and you get emotional about them. So it's kind of a nice balance. But what tricks me up is that in the times that I've been with you guys on camera, I don't ever see you switch over. I never see you like, okay, I'm talent now. Which is kind of admirable. And it's hard to believe that you guys have figured out how to do that.
I throw tantrums off screen.
Do you throw them off screen?
I do, yeah. So I make outrageous demands.
So you got a rider that's like really ridiculous.
Got only green jelly beans and
But was there ever a moment where you thought, either of you thought, oh, this is actually a little harder than it works. This is actually hard.
Definitely. But the first time I saw myself, I thought I was so boring on camera. I remember in the very first season.
So why? What did you do that you thought was boring?
My energy level and was low and my facial expressions were non-existent. I felt like I just droned on and didn't have much facial expression.
So did you like give notes, edit notes, cut that guy out, cut more of his stuff out because he's boring?
Because
that's got to be hard.
I cut out the parts of myself that I thought were most damning to me. Yeah, definitely.
So but you didn't do that necessarily if it was best for the show, but what made you look better?
Oh, of course.
Okay. That's my prerogative.
Well,
I
would argue both.
Yeah.
No, Susie, do you get to throw in notes about what to cut out? Because he's in programming, so he can do that.
No, you
can't do that.
I will tell you, in all the years I've been doing this, I've had two babies and been breastfeeding both of those babies. So there were
the show, I just want to mention. But.
Well, no, they've cut that out. I'm kidding. But there have been some issues of back fat. And so once I've seen...
Back fat?
Back fat, yes. I've been chunkier.
From what angle could anybody see back fat?
But it was a bad angle. That's exactly. It was a bad angle. So I remember saying once, you have to remove that angle. It was the burger challenge in the kitchens. I can remember it perfectly.
So my back all fat of these things are going on. You're deciding the fate... of other people.
Can I tell you, it's made me better in my job in two ways, being on camera. It's made me more sensitive to our talent, like you, because I understand there are things that trip up your performance. So I understand, like, intimately now, anything that distracts you from just being yourself on camera, whether it seems petty or not, it has to be dealt with. Because the most important thing is for a talent for the cameras to melt away and for the cameras to just be the talent to just be themselves. And anything that makes them think about the production, the cameras, is a bad thing. And I know that now. And so I'm very...
Yeah, but you also have the experience of being a producer. You know the machinations of the system.
But I never understood it. I always thought that people were being petty and I just sort of dealt with it. And now I understand why those things are important to them. And things like makeup and hair, because they feel like if I'm thinking about how I'm looking on camera, I'm not actually focusing on what I'm supposed to be doing, whether I'm cooking or judging or traveling or interviewing. I'm thinking about other things, and that's now I see it comes with the territory. Mm-hmm.
So it's a distraction that needs to be minimized.
Right. But and a sensitivity, and therefore a sensitivity.
And I also realize for the contestants, I realize how much the camera really does eat up energy, that thing we say that the first season. I thought I was being big and loud and expressive, and I looked like I had had Botox throughout my face. Like I just was not very interesting, which I never have, by the way.
Never have.
Just
no
naturally
hey,
youthful.
Don't knock it.
So anyway, so I've just learned a lot about being on camera. By being on camera, that's been very useful.
What about you, Susie? Same thing?
For me, the most interesting learning experience through this show has been how to have hard conversations. I've actually learned a lot about how to have the courage to have a tough conversation, keep it small. And I think that's really helpful when you're doing reviews at work, right? Conversations. I'm having very intimate and difficult conversations with people, and it's very scary, you know, to give feedback to someone that you barely know, but that you sort of rooting for. It's a tough conversation to have, somehow you need to let them know that you care for them while you're going to flatten them. And then you need to pick them back up, right? You right. do this, Alton, very well. And it means you
yeah,
care.
Yeah, but I'm not comfortable with it.
Not comfortable, but no. But this is a hard thing in life to know how to do. And as a what I would hope to be a good leader to my team, you have to have difficult conversations. Difficult conversations with talent sometimes, difficult conversations with direct reports. This show has given me more courage to have difficult conversations.
Do you think that's because it's forced you to be more concise and more kind of organized in your thoughts
yes.
and more
yes.
Focused?
Yes. I think my faux pas, which I probably fall into every now and again, is rambling. So Bob's so concise. I always say, I'll
that's
say
true.
It, and then Bob will find a better way to say it. So
I crib off Susie.
Well, some people call that teamwork. I mean, that's completely
you know,
fun.
But whatever works best for the show, you know, it's not so important for me to have those three moments, to Bob's three moments, like whatever's best for the show. I see it as a job.
You know, there are a lot of shows on a lot of networks that are mean-spirited, that don't care about helping anybody. Do you feel that consistently, and this is a question for both of you, do you feel consistently that Food Network Star has been a positive show?
I do. I don't. I would love to hear if there's anybody who felt they were mistreated by the show.
I've never actually heard that.
I've never heard that, and I think most people have benefited, and I've heard feedback from from scores of people who have thanked me for their time on the show and told me how it's benefited them in their lives, whether they're chefs or restaurateurs mm-hmm. or caterers. They seem to have been grateful for it. And I thought the chance to sit with not just three of the biggest television food stars in history ever and get their wisdom, but also then to have Susie and I mean, I can't think of a room that has more talent in the thing you say you want to do and is weeks and weeks of learning aimed at you. Like, what an unbelievable opportunity. So I think even people who don't make it very far, they feel like they've gotten, at least a great bite of the apple.
Well, it's like going to a really good university in a way. I mean, you're exposed to people that can give you a lot of feedback, mm-hmm. a great deal of feedback. Have there been people that have fallen by the wayside that you think back to and think, wow, if we had done this differently or we'd done this differently, that person could have been the next guy, that person could have been the next Robert Irvine, or that person could have been the next Giada, but we just missed it somehow? Or do you think that by and large, you get it right every year? Either one of you.
I don't know that we get it right every year. I don't know. I don't think we get it right every year.
Is that the nature of the game? I mean, is that the
only thing I would say is that there has been a more than one instance where people who didn't win Food Network Star ended up getting a show later on because we thought they were
right,
talent.
Worthy. Yeah,
and I don't regret doing that at all. And someone like Kelsey Nixon, who we said over and over during the season that she was on, we love you. You're just too young. You just don't have enough experience to teach people
right.
about cooking. You just learned it yourself. 5 years later, she's the first to say, you were so right. She's now is a big star on Cooking Channel.
Right.
But she said every time I see her, you were right. I was not ready then, and I didn't realize it at the time. Only now am I ready for it.
Interesting.
And so I actually think we've done the right thing. I can't think of a specific person thinking, you know what? Oh, they were a diamond in the rough, and if only we had carried them through further. Because some of those people did end up getting shows. And even if they were good in the shows, they didn't turn into bigger stars down the line. So I think by and large, we've done it right.
Mm. The thing is that it's not, even if you have an idea of who you would like to win, that person doesn't necessarily win, right? It's not my decision who wins. I'm part of a decision-making body. So,
interesting. Of course, this is a show that's going to be heading into, hopefully, its 10th year next year. And out of that, you've gotten one megastar. Is that a good record? Is that, I mean, you must look back on that and say that in 9 years of Food Network Star, we've had one mega star, which would be Guy Fieri. Is that a good record?
Yeah, I think you can't look at Guy as the exception. So I think the fact that we got a Guy would make 10 seasons of the show worth it. It would make 20 seasons of the show worth it.
And that's my question.
However, you can't just look at Guy because Melissa D'Arabian has had a show on the air since she launched, a very, very popular show,
mm-hmm.
And has been in our magazine and has been popular sort of throughout the Food Network family. Even in the first year, I mean, there's nobody who hasn't gotten like at least, a couple seasons of a show. So while you look at the biggest example, I think if you look at the track record of everybody and the number of total episodes and seasons that they've done, I can't think of another show. I mean, American Idol has had so many winners that you can't remember the day after they're crowned.
So, absolutely.
But
true.
I think for them to get a Carrie Underwood and a Kelly Clarkson is amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
So I don't think you can look at that every season has to be a star. I think if you get a couple big stars and a lot of medium stars, boy, it's proved its worth over and over and over again.
Now, there are a lot of competition shows. What makes and what has continued to make Food Network stars so potent in that category?
I'll just pull back. I think one thing is that, 10 years ago, we pulled back the curtain on how this was done. And I think that was unique. I don't think there are even shows today that are successful that do that. Like, I think the power behind what was going on there at Food Network and who are these people, I think who are these people that are making these decisions, I think it is intriguing for, you know, for us to have an opportunity to unmask, you know, some of the executives at Food. I think it just gets more interesting when you add the talent in who do this for a living. You're wildly entertaining, Jada, Bobby. I mean, it's a pretty good crew to hang out with. But I think also there's an honesty to the show. So while it's not necessarily, it's a popular show, but it's not a means to an end. You know, the end is to find the star to then be able to work with. There's not a lot of shows that do that either. You can, you know, win money for a restaurant. You can be the best duo that out-sleuthed every type of adventure thrown at you. But to really have a place in this family, I think, is a huge promise.
I also think the unique duo of skills we're asking you, that not only do you have to be a great cook, which a lot of shows get at, but you have to be an entertaining, charismatic TV star while you do that, is a really unique combo that no other show looks at. There's a lot of cooking shows. And there are shows that are about star power, but there's nothing that sort of merges those two. And I think as people have gotten, as Food Network has grown huge, as you guys have become huge stars, I think people are interested in how does that happen? How do you become that star? What do you need to become that? Because you guys do make it look so easy. And I think the show shows you, no, we just make it look easy. It is anything but easy.
As you have watched the last decade plus unfold, what are some of the greater attributes or the positives that you have seen or you believe exist that this network and food programming in general has had upon culture? What good has been done here?
I think it has ignited this huge interest in food, where it comes from, how it's prepared, what flavors exist. I think people have become more interested, more curious, and more adventurous in their food taste. And I think you see that in the wide range of ethnic flavors that, I mean, kids now grow up. When I grew up, you know, we had like meat and potatoes, and I grew up in the Midwest. It was pretty straightforward and pretty kind of, you know, 60s-ish. And I think now the kids who are growing up with sushi and ramen and curries, that's just what they eat every day. And what do you want for dinner tonight? I'd like a, you know, basmati rice and some sort of cauliflower curry. Like, that wasn't an option when I was growing up.
No, so. I don't remember a lot of that either.
I am jealous of kids who are growing up in such, not only a multicultural world, but also just such a wide, interesting, adventurous world. And I just think like their world has so few boundaries, where mine was nothing but boundaries.
Interesting. What about you, Susie?
Mine probably sounds a little cliched, maybe even a little cheesy, but I think it's a safe topic, you know, and I think it really does bring people together. I have met so many people in my travels that are connected through Food Network. You know, moms and daughters that don't talk all week, but they watch Anne Burrell. And she's cool enough for the kids, but the mom thinks she's, you know, safe zone still for the kids. Or guys that love Bobby Flay and, you know, come out of the, you know, come out to have the book signed and are not afraid to say, write it to Jim, you know, instead of Jane. People that are inspired to get into food. I've just met so many special needs kids that started working in kitchens because of shows like Chopped, and so many stories that mothers tell that Food Network has inspired my family. I met a guy on the subway once who was in tears because he and his wife were probably on the outs, but they started cooking together in the kitchen, and tears in his eyes on the subway in New York City. Like, you saved my marriage. I was like, I didn't do any of that, but I love Food Network too. So when people stop me and say, I love Food Network, I say, me too. And I think more often than not, it's something so much more personal than television. So to be able to do that, you know, and call that marketing, that's a pretty cool thing to be a part of.
When you think about all of the issues going on in food these days, whether it's obesity or, you know, different farming methods and sustainability and all of that, we kind of have to reckon with the fact that we're now players in this, that we affect food culture in this country. Does that, knowing that we have, you have, we all have, responsibility now in that, and does that in any way flavor your job and the way that you do your jobs? Because on one hand, you need to make entertaining shows that rate well. On the other hand, you influence a bigger part of culture, a critical part of culture. How do you reckon with that?
I think there's several ways we do. One is we have a lot of platforms that we have besides the TV network. So there's the magazine. We have a huge digital presence. So we're able, on the digital, there's certain areas that work of interest that aren't big enough maybe for television at this point, things like vegetarian cooking, things like gluten-free cooking, that we can get at in a way to satisfy viewers or users through digital or through the magazine. So I don't look at the TV network as the only way that we can do things. But we've done a couple specials in the last years that I've been very proud of. We did a hunger special in conjunction with Share Our Strength, who we're partners with, called Hunger Hits Home, which was about the problem of childhood hunger in America, which I thought was both a very moving documentary. I hate to use the word entertaining about a subject like that, but I thought it was very gripping. But it also did a service. Share Our Strength tells us all the time how much money they raise through it, how much they still use it as a tool throughout schools. I'm so happy that something we did has had such an effect both on viewers and for an organization that's doing so much good in the world. We also did a show about the problem of food waste called The Big Waste,
sure.
Which to me was the best of all worlds because it was a competition between four chefs to make meals out of just items that had been thrown out in our food system. We throw away tons of foods every day. I mean,
literally.
Yeah. I wish I had numbers because you hear them. It's shocking how much perfectly good food gets thrown away in the supermarket, in homes, at farmers markets, at restaurants. They had to make a meal out of it. And while it sounds gross, the food is perfectly usable. It has a spot on it. It has a blemish. So anyway, it was so enlightening to the chefs. And it was Bobby Flay and Mike Simon and Ann Burrell and Alex Garnaschelli. And these are huge chefs with, you know, they know restaurants. They know the food world. They were shocked at what they learned. And so the viewer, it was eye-opening for the viewer, but it was very entertaining. So we're always looking for areas where we can both make great programming and have an effect. And the truth is it's not easy, but we're still looking for the next special and the special after that.
Got it. Susie?
So if we're not part of the solution, then we're part of the problem. And I think that we're setting our sights. I personally and Food Network setting our sights on really helping educate via Share Our Strength's efforts, via food banks. But once you get the food, what do you do with it? So I think that's sort of our next wave of support with regards to hungry kids, kids that are food insecure, and parents. I mean, it's a luxury sometimes to get a fresh tomato, but then what do you even do with it? Once you get it. So that's our responsibility, I think, we teach, inspire, entertain. We've got the right organization. They've got the reach. We've got the passion. We've got the know-how. We have people like you that we know will help us. So it's, to me, our best foot forward is education and nutrition around food.
So you've got responsibility where, I mean, there aren't many networks that have responsibility. But because of the subject that this network is based on, you do, whether you want it or not.
I also think we can't overlook the fact that we have taught now a generation how to cook. So whereas in you know, my mom learned how to cook from her mom, I learned how to cook from my mom. But after me, a lot of kids, their moms are working. You know, both parents are working. Yep. They don't have the time, unfortunately, to teach them. And you and the other stars in our network really have taught people how to cook. And I think you can't underestimate what that does for nutrition, what that does for health, what that does for keeping families together. And so I think the cooking, the instructional parts of our programming has done an infinite amount of good beyond any issues.
Bob Tushman, Susie Fogelson, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elton.
One thing that's really unique about figs after you pull them off the tree, if you refrigerate them, or if you just leave them out on the counter, sometimes they'll get these little white crystals that come up on the surface. And that's referred to in the fig trade as sugaring. And it literally is fructose crystals on the outside of the fruits. Just it kind of sweats out of them from just being so gosh darn ripe. Figs are, 80% water, and they are very, very perishable. So I usually freeze them, but then you can certainly also cook them down into to preserves and jams, which is what I do with about half of my crop during the year. The other half I trade to other people around the area for things like tomatoes. You have to be careful when you cook with figs. They contain an enzyme called ficin, which acts kind of like pepin in papayas and bromelain in pineapples, meaning they can break down proteins and it can make meats kind of taste mushy on the outside. So if you're going to add them to a cooked dish, you probably want to cook them first. Some people say that figs will help tenderize meat. I don't. I think it just makes the meat disgusting. So keep that in mind whenever you get in the mood to bring figs and meat together. Especially pork.
All right, now it's time to answer some of your questions.
And we continue to find new victims for phone conversations here on the Alton Browncast. More people either curious about food or I wish somebody would ask me something about something besides food. I do know other things besides food, but nobody wants to talk about anything but food, and that's the way it goes. All right, Connor, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Connor, where are you?
Texas.
What part of Texas? That's a big state.
DFW.
Oh, okay, excellent. So, you have a question for me, sir.
Well, first off, I'd like to ask. I was in Austin a couple of years ago, and I heard you talking about making a children's cookbook. And as much as I don't want to be cooked by my parents, I'd really like to see you make a kid-centric book.
Meaning one that's for kids, not based on kids as an ingredient.
Yes.
Because that's a whole different book and a very different market. Because I could see a lot of parents who would buy both of those, actually, especially if they're bad little children. Right. I'm not writing a book this year. I decided to take a year off as I kind of plan what the next book's going to be. And I'm having increasing pressure placed on me by the kid lobby, so to speak, to do a kid's cooking book. So I guess I'm going to have to kind of start moving that up to the top of the heap. Now, you go get a publisher and call me when you get the deal in place. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Excellent, Connor. I'll be waiting to hear from you. Just tweet to me. Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Next up on the Alton Browncast, we're going to talk to Meredith. Are you there, Meredith?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. I have some questions for you. This is so cool that I can talk with you.
Well, here we are. go ahead with your first question. Hopefully I'll be able to manage it.
Okay, so I have a question. So you went on this whole, you were on a big health kick and you've become like a lot healthier. And I'm trying to learn to cook, except all recipes have a ton of oil and a ton of butter and a ton of fat in them.
So you want to cook healthy, but most of the recipes you find have too much bad stuff in them, or too much good stuff in them, depending on how you look at it.
Exactly. There's too much good stuff, but I want to make good food that still tastes good.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Knowing where and when you can do that really matters. Biscuits without fat aren't biscuits. They're little hard clods of flour. So you can't... you can switch out the fats, but you can't get rid of them there. So I think that you kind of have to decide where you use the fats where they need to be and then don't use them where they don't need to be. For instance, people in America tend to stir fry and saute with way more fat than they actually need. And one of the ways that I get around that is, for instance, let's say that I find a recipe for a vegetable chicken stir fry. Okay. And that recipe is going to call because it's been written for a fry pan instead of a wok. So it's automatically going to have more fat in it. What I do is instead of putting any fat in the pan at all, I simply toss all the ingredients in a little bit of fat in a bowl so that they're all thoroughly covered, but with a very, very, very thin layer of oil. And then I cook the recipe as written. So anytime that it's put fat in a pan or add fat to something, unless it's like a batter or dough, I usually just try to put the fat on the food in a smaller amount.
That makes so much sense. I mean, but also, does the chicken dry out easier? Like you're talking about making stir-fried chicken. I feel like whenever I make it, the chicken gets really dry.
Okay, let me tell you why the chicken gets dry. The chicken does not get dry because you use too much oil. The chicken dries because you cook it too slowly over too low of heat.
Oh.
need more heat so that you can cook it quickly. The longer it's in the pan, the more it dries out. That's especially true of a dish where you've got a lot of strips or pieces of something like a stir fry. You want to get that in at a very, very high heat. Get the cooking over with before the meat has a chance to lose all of its juices.
That is fantastic advice.
Well, thanks very much for calling. Go forth and cook.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Bye-bye. Continuing on with the Alton Browncast, I want to turn my attention to Twitter. I get a lot of good questions from people on Twitter. Somebody named Vic, V-I-Q, asked me if I have any ideas for watermelon rind besides composting or sweet pickles. Well, there are a lot of different pickles and chow chows chutneys that can be made with watermelon rind, and you can find those recipes all over the internet. But here's the thing. Around my house, most of the watermelon rind gets fed to the dogs. Apparently, not only do dogs, every dog that I've seen so far, really like watermelon rind, it apparently is pretty good for them. I've done a fair amount of research and talked to vets about this thing, and they say, yeah, watermelon rind's fine for dogs. They love to chew on it, nice and juicy. So if you don't want to make pickles, get a dog. That's what I would do.
Here's another question from Twitter that I like a lot. It comes from Matt O. And Matt O asks me if, all caps, you would be so kind. I was curious to know if you would ever add anything to a fruit salad other than fruit and lemon juice. Well, most certainly, Matt, I would. Number one, I would add herbs. One of my favorite things in a fruit salad is a fine chiffonade of mint. I find that the aroma and the flavor of mint adds a lot to fruit, especially melons. And I also like the color quite a bit. The other thing that I add a lot of is cheese. I love me some feta on fruit salad or various Italian hard cheeses. Pecorino Romano is a good one. I usually don't go with super – well, no, the feta is a pretty soft cheese, but, you know, crumbling cheese. Is something good. I've also been known to put a fine sprinkling of chili powder on my fruit salad because I just like I like that flavor of just having a little bit of chili and of course salt because I almost always put salt on a fruit salad. Okay, here's one. This comes from Betsy. Hi, Betsy. Betsy says, what cheese would you suggest for a Monte Cristo? A Monte Cristo sandwich, of course, a fried, usually a batter dipped and fried version of a really kind of a croque monsieur sandwich. So I've never been very good at saying that, croque monsieur sandwich. And being such, you know, sometimes they put a jam or jelly inside of them. That's my favorite. But still, I'm going to be a traditionalist when it comes to the cheese, Betsy, and I'm going to go with either an Emmental or a Gruyere. Gruyere would be even better. I think it's pretty fabulous when melted. So that's how I'm going to play that one. Another culinary question from Twitter. This is from Zelda McGregor. That is an awesome name, Zelda. I mean, first off, Zelda's already cool, but when you throw a name like McGregor on the back of it, that's pretty cool. Of course, McGregor, a famous character on a TV show I used to make on Food Network, was my neighbor, and he had a large rifle. Anyway, doesn't matter. Zelda wants to know why mayonnaise is white and hollandaise is yellow. She seems tweeted me several times about this. Well, okay. This is not too hard. Let's think about it. One, most hollandaise recipes have more egg yolks in them than most mayonnaise recipes. When you actually look at the ratio of egg yolks to other ingredients, it's typically higher in a hollandaise. Okay, so let's face it, egg yolks are extremely yellow, so that would add to some of that. The other thing is the fat that's being used. Not typically, always. Mayonnaise is made with oil. And hollandaise is made with butter, typically clarified butter. So that's also yellow. Then you've got the fact that there's usually more lemon in – a lot more lemon actually in hollandaise than there is in mayonnaise. So I would say that any one of those three, and you can kind of take your pick. But I'm going to say that it's primarily the use of additional egg yolks. The last comment I'm going to take from Twitter today is from someone who was calling me out on something. They were absolutely right to do so. I had answered someone who was trying to convert a British baking recipe and was confused by some terminology, and I missed part of the question, and it was about the fact that in England very often, or in the UK in general, self-rising flour is often called self-raising flour. Okay, self-raising flour and self Rising Flower are the same thing. I missed it. I just wasn't reading very carefully. And now hopefully I have done penance for that. Anyway, so thanks, Twitter folk, for bringing forth some of your questions. What I wish I could do is I wish that I can make good Fig Newtons, and I'm still working on that. Of course, the Fig Newton's been around since, it's one of the oldest cookies, 1892, I want to say, invented by, hold on a second, I love this up, James Henry Mitchell developed a machine that could produce a cookie that had a cake-like texture but could be filled, and that was kind of key to that. And the problem is it's really tough to make them without that machine. Of course, that ended up in the hands of National Biscuit Company, which, of course, is now Nabisco. The home of the National Biscuit Company was Chelsea Market, the big Chelsea Market building in Chelsea, New York, which is now home to Food Network. So got a little bit of connection there. But the place does not smell like Fig Newtons. I kind of wish it did. So another Alton Brown cast comes to a close. I want to thank Susie Fogelson and Bob Tushman from Food Network for spending some time with us and giving us some insight into the challenges of their job and, of course, of finding Food Network stars every year. Anyway, I'm Alton Brown. Thanks for listening once again to the Alton Brown cast. We'll hopefully speak to you again soon. And remember, America, in the meantime, cook smart.